Good morning, and welcome to Unity Church on this cloudy, rainy day. I want to extend a special welcome to those of you who are here for the first time. We hope that you find Unity to be a place which helps you to find and keep your balance, a place which nourishes you and inspires you to lead a loving life of integrity, service, and joy. I'd like to call your attention to this week at Unity, which serves as an invitation and a roadmap to deeper involvement here. After the service, we hope you'll join us in the parish hall for coffee and tea. There you can see new friends and old. You can introduce yourself to someone you've never met before, and stop by the information tables to catch up on what's happening here at Unity. If you're interested in becoming a member, please visit the welcome table in the parish hall. Next week, we will welcome Richard Fouché, a member of Unity Church, as our special speaker with music by Digging for Apples. Carrie and I would like to greet you following the service at the Portland Avenue doors, and once again, welcome to Unity. Let's step for a time from the world of errands and cell phones, from the world of industrial production and the exchange of cash, from the worry of bridges and highway closures. Let's take a breath and pause to sense our deeper connection to the world and the beings around us in the music, the readings, the silence, the songs, the reflections we share with each other. Let us worship together.
Thank you.
please remain standing for unison reading number 613. You could have golden treasure buried beneath your feet and walk over it again and again, yet never find it because you don't realize it is there. Just so, all beings live every moment in the city of the divine, but never find the divine because it is hidden by the well of illusion. Please be seated.
Each time we gather for worship, whether in the chapel with the children or here in the sanctuary, we take a moment to bring into the loving embrace of this community those who are facing great sorrow, celebrating a new joy, or marking a great turning in their lives. I will begin with the names of those who are in the need of the very real love and care of this congregation, and then it will be your turn to speak the names of those whom you have brought with you in your hearts and minds. Our thoughts are with Marion Wallace as she continues to live through her final days under the care of hospice and her granddaughter. We hold in our hearts Jim Sen, who is also under the care of hospice. We think of love of Virginia Rader, who continues to recover at Shalom Home. We hold also in our hearts Jane O'Brien, who lost her sister, Anne Elizabeth O'Connor, last week. A service for Anne's memory was held last week. We think lovingly of Hope Barker, who lost her beloved uncle, Lynn Olson, last week as well. Sherry Long is recovering well from her recent surgery. We pray for her continued healing. And we gratefully celebrate the return of Harper Hearn Danielson, who came home from the hospital. Betsy, Drew, Addie, and all the other members of their ecstatic family are thrilled. We are delighted, too, to share the joy of two Unity couples who were married last weekend. Carrie McIntyre and Gordon Lee were married here in the sanctuary. And Laura Sewell and Peter Freeman were married on Sunday. We pray, too, for all those who live with poverty of spirit and of opportunity, and we pray for those who live in the midst of habitual violence. May they and we be instruments of a lasting peace. I now invite you to speak the names of those people whom you wish to bring into this sacred space. The names that have been spoken, and the names which remain in the silent sanctuary of our hearts, and for all those lives that have touched ours, we are grateful. Please join me in a moment of prayerful reflection. My friends, let us give thanks for wonder. Let us give thanks for the wonder of life that infuses all things now and forever. Blessed is the source of life, the fountain of being, the wellspring of goodness, compassion, and kindness from which we draw to make for justice and peace. From the creative power of life, we derive food and harvest. From the bounty of the earth and the yields of the heavens, we are sustained and are able to sustain others. All life is holy, sacred, worthy of respect and dignity. Let us give thanks for the power of heart to sense the holy in the midst of the simple. May we eat not simply to satisfy our own appetites, but may we eat to sustain ourselves in the tasks we have been given. Each of us is unique, coming into the world with a gift no other can offer, ourselves. May we eat to nourish the vehicle of giving. May we eat to sustain our task of world repair, our quest for harmony, peace, and justice. When we eat, may we be revived, and may we give thanks to the lives that were ended to nourish our own. May we merit their sacrifice and honor their sparks of holiness through our deeds of loving kindness. We give thanks to the power that makes for meeting, for gatherings are a place of dialogue and friendship. We give thanks to life. May we never lose touch with the simple joy and wonder of good food. May it be so, and amen.
Will the ushers please come forward? And thank you. I'd love to be able to just play something else. So wonderful. Oh, I'm sorry. Ushers, I rushed you. Sorry. Sorry, Barbara.
Good morning. I'm Barbara Hubbard, the Director of Administration, and I am here this morning to honor and celebrate Mark Lynch. Mark, would you join me? Mark was hired in the fall of 1998, actually by Maura, I see you sitting here, as the coordinator of communications at Unity Church. Over these past 9 years, I have had the honor and the pleasure of working with Mark. The church has changed and grown in dramatic ways. We've seen the departure of Roy Phillips and the first 7 years of Jan and Rob's settled ministry. Our staff has grown, our programs have rooted and blossomed, and Mark has been integral to the vibrant and growing ministries of the church. He has handled the multi-layered challenges of his job with skill, creativity, and unending good cheer. He's been the man behind the curtain, preparing the newsletters, the orders of service, our pledge materials, brochures, mass email, the website, and all other communications of the church. Many of you know him to be the voice on the phone, too, as he has backed up our volunteers and our staff members as our frontline hospitality. Mark, your contributions and your bright spirit will be felt at Unity Church for a long time to come, and we are deeply grateful to you for sharing your gifts with us. Now it's time to bid Mark farewell and to wish him the best in his new endeavors. Mark will begin at the Humphrey Institute in September, where he will pursue a Master's of Public Policy in Urban Development. As a farewell gift, we're giving Mark a gift certificate for a bed and breakfast weekend with LJ. To honor Mark's work with the church, to celebrate their recent marriage, and to give him an opportunity to take a breath before beginning the next chapter. Please join me in saying goodbye to Mark at a reception in the parish hall following the service. And please take a moment here to honor Mark.
The ushers are already forward. Today's offering will be shared with The Family Place, an organization that supports homeless families with children in St. Paul. There will be a one-to-one match for the offering today from an anonymous donor in honor of Bartlett Baker, a longtime member of Unity Church who died in 2005. Please give generously, and may this offering be a blessing to those who give as well as those who receive.
Thank you.
The first reading today is a poem by Edwin Brock called The Song of the Battery Hen. And I'll just mention that battery farming for chickens refers to the practice of having thousands of birds all in the same building in wire mesh cages that they never leave, with a wire mesh bottom so the waste can drop through and is taken away on a conveyor belt. Eggs drop down through a chute and there's no contact with the outside world. The Song of the Battery Hen. We can't grumble about accommodation. We have a new concrete floor that's always dry, four walls that are painted white, and a sheet iron roof the rain drops on. A fan blows warm air beneath our feet to disperse the smell of chicken dung, and on dull days, fluorescent lighting sees us. You can tell me. If you come by the north door, I am in the 12th pen on the left-hand side of the third row from the floor, and in that pen, I am usually the middle one of three. But even without directions, you'd discover me. I have the same orange-red comb, yellow beak, and auburn feathers. But as the door opens and you hear above the electric fan a kind of one-word wail, I am the one who sounds loudest in my head. Listen. Outside this house, there's an orchard with small moss-green apple trees. Beyond that, two fields of cabbages. Then, on the far side of the road, a broiler house. Listen. One cockerel grows out there, as tall and proud as the first hour of sun. Sometimes I stop calling with the others to listen and wonder if he hears me. The next time you come here, look for me. Notice the way I sound inside my head. God made us all quite differently and blessed us with this expensive home.
Please stay comfortably in your roosts and join with me in reading responsibly in your order of worship. The animal shall not be measured by man. Gifted with extensions of the senses we have lost or never attained. They are not brethren. They are not underlings.
They are other nations, caught up with ourselves in the net of life and time, fellow prisoners of the slender, fearful of the river.
And a reading from the prophet by Cahil Gibran. Then an old man, a keeper of an inn, said, "Speak to us of eating and drinking." And he said, "Would that you could live on the fragrance of the earth and, like an air plant, be sustained by the light. But since you must kill to eat and rob the young of its mother's milk to quench your thirst, let it then be an act of worship. And let your board stand an altar on which the pure and the innocent of forest and plain are sacrificed for that which is purer and still more innocent in many. When you kill a beast, say to him in your heart, 'By the same power that slays you, I too am slain, and I too shall be consumed, for the law that delivered you into my hand shall deliver me into a mightier hand. Your blood and my blood is naught but the sap that feeds the tree of heaven.' And when you crush an apple with your teeth, say to it in your heart, 'Your seeds shall live in my body, and the buds of your tomorrow shall blossom in my heart, and your fragrance shall be my breath, and together we shall rejoice through all the seasons. And in the autumn, when you gather the grapes of your vineyard for the wine press, say in your heart, I too am a vineyard, and my fruit shall be gathered for the wine press, and like new wine, I shall be kept in eternal vessels. And in winter, when you draw the wine, let there be in your heart a song for each cup, and let there be in the song a remembrance for the autumn days, and for the vineyard, and for the wine press.
Let me start with two bits of reassuring news. First, Marigold, who is a rooster and not just a really butch hen like I was hoping, has in fact several options for good homes in the future where he will be able to crow his little heart out. Secondly, while this topic is a bit of a stretch, I am not alone, not even the first to wax philosophical at the thought of an egg. I think you should know that John Bunyan, shortly after the publication of The Pilgrim's Progress, turned his attention to the religious education of children through chicken-inspired metaphors in his book for boys and girls, or Temporal Things Spiritualized. So here's this from Meditations Upon an Egg for Children, Part 1. The egg's no chick by falling from the hen, nor man a Christian till he's born again. The egg's at first contained in the shell, men afore grace in sins and darkness dwell. The egg, when laid by warmth, is made a chicken, and Christ by grace those dead in sin doth quicken. The egg, when first a chick, the shell's its prison, sows flesh to the soul who yet with Christ is risen. It goes on. I'm going to stop there. But if you would like me to share the rest of this clever little text with a boy or girl in your life, you just let me know. Barbara Kingsolver, whose theology lies a little more in line with my own than Bunyan's does, writes in Animal Vegetable Miracle that it takes something on the order of religion to invoke new, more conscious behaviors, especially about the food that people put in their mouths. And this seems about right to me when I think along the lines of Leviticus or Ramadan, or Friday night fish fries. All along, we've all had a notion that God has notions about what and how we should eat, and that somehow how we feed our bodies is at the same time connected to nourishing our souls. For me, food behaviors have always been at the center of my consciousness, but I'm not sure at exactly what point I realized that I agreed with Kingsolver and that specifically choosing to raise my own chickens was motivated by something like religion. That I'm, as Thoreau describes it, seeking that inexpressible satisfaction that has nothing to do with appetite. That this is as much about filling the God-shaped hollow inside me as it is about filling my stomach. I know that there was a formative experience about 15 years ago when I went with my college roommate to her family's factory-scale poultry farm, where I stood up to my knees, up to my disinfected rubber-booted knees, in turkey pullets by the tens of thousands, birds that had never seen the sun, moving around my legs in great lost waves and running brainlessly into the metal walls of their whole world every time I took a step. That image is with me. But I suspect that the idea of chicken keepings being a spiritual enterprise really settled into me kind of after the fact, after I had already got the chicks, and I think it actually happened, of course, while I was talking to a kid. The neighbor kid, John, has been coming over nearly every day since June, when the chickens moved out from underneath their glowing red heat lamp into the finally sun-warmed backyard. Now, these are some of the same neighbors you might have heard me worry about a couple Halloweens ago. Neighbors who aren't too sure about the girl next door who has the altogether wrong political signs in her front yard and who doesn't have any boyfriends coming around. And these neighbors didn't automatically send their kids over to my place, which was an unnatural shock for me as a genetically endowed kid magnet. But the chickens have been a catalyst for a small change in my relationship with my neighbors. I had to ask my nearest neighbors for permission to keep the chickens. So we had to have a conversation about who I am and who they are. I met the Hmong family who lives right behind me for the very first time since I moved in when I had them sign the permit. And I thought, isn't it interesting that Mr. Vang was less surprised that I wanted to keep chickens than he was that I didn't have them already? Somehow, the chickens have become implicit permission for the neighbors to come over and have a conversation. So my yard has always fascinated John, who's 9, with its unusual productivity. It freaked him out a little when he found out that I actually eat the mulberries and the apples off my trees, because that involves dirt, a little too close to dirt. But last year, he and I occasionally started snacking out of the rhubarb patch and out of the strawberry patches. So this year, he sat over on his side of the fence and watched, kind of absentmindedly destroying the family picnic table with a baseball bat while he sat there, while Jen and I put in about 4 dozen tomato plants into the ground. Like a lot of American kids I know, John is mostly entertained passively by something that's got a power source, and he sometimes seems at a loss for what to do with himself when he's outdoors. Since when he watches me, he gets a notion that I have a little idea of what one does when one's outside. I've been a curiosity to him, but he's still been pretty much, on the whole, wary. The chickens, though, provoked an irresistible curiosity, and he and his cousins and some of the other neighbor kids have been coming over now regularly and keeping tabs on this whole endeavor. Now this, as you might know, has been a wicked good year for the Japanese beetles of the world, and John had absorbed his dad's concern about the damage the beetles were doing to all of our yards, mostly to the neighborly raspberry bramble that spans the chain-link fence between our two front yards. In my new role as chicken ambassador, I told John and his dad one day that my chickens would so happily take care of this beetle problem, but that I couldn't let them range freely out there so close to the street.
John's eyes got wide. Chickens eat bugs. They had just got a lot cooler in John's estimation. You could see the little wheels in his head's turning. Ooh, but how to get the bugs to the chickens in such a way that I can witness their crunchy, beaky demise? And John disappeared and came back with Tupperware. And garden gloves for the first 2 days, but those became unnecessary the moment his girl cousins came over for a visit. My chicken's diet was greatly improved by lots of hand picking and running back and forth to the coop with his mom's kitchen storage, where two of the chickens, one of them's not clever enough to figure bugs out, two of the chickens polished off each batch of 2 or 3 dozen beetles in about half a second. So morning and evening, John was at my beleaguered grapevine and our attacked raspberries, saving them from the Japanese beetles. One evening he came and he knocked at my door and he asked me if I would help him give the grapevine a once over because he was so sure that there were more beetles hiding underneath, but he couldn't turn the leaves over and wield the Tupperware trap at the same time. So he asked me to come out and help. And as we hunted, we talked. We counted back weeks and tried to guess when the chickens might start laying their first eggs. We talked about how much they poop and why I have to drag the coop every day because the yard can, in fact, have too much of a good thing. And we talked about how they're eating a lot of the creeping Charlie along with some of the grass. And we talked about the chickens until John fell quiet mid-conversation. He was thinking. And then, kind of turning the Tupperware, watching the shadows of the Japanese beetles inside, he starts talking. "So hey," he says, "the poop feeds the plants, and these bugs are eating the plants, and then the chickens are eating the bugs. And well, they eat some of the plants too, but they eat the bugs, and then we're gonna eat the eggs, and then we're gonna feed the chickens more bugs. It's kind of a, and he looked at me, I swear, for the first time since I've lived next door to him, looked at me, and it's clear that he's looking for an important word, for an important new idea that's come into his head, and me being who I am, I'm sort of waiting for the M word, but he says, "It's sort of a thing." And I'm trying to neither laugh nor cry, right? So I nod and I say, "You are so right, John. It is a thing, isn't it?" Model of restraint. I did not add, "We like to call the thing life. And some of us even call it a miracle. And isn't it so good to have so much of it so nearby to watch and know and love?" I don't think I needed to add that, because I think that John was starting to get the chicken thing. So now, the chickens spend every day waiting for John's bugs. And I'm spending every day waiting for John's next epiphany. I'm hoping, kind of, that he might launch into a kid version of an extemporaneous treatise on some of the bad things in our world, like our unsustainable and inequitable petroleum-based food system, or maybe the reduction of animal life to commodity in the decades since their relegation outside of our cities and outside our moral proximity. This hasn't happened yet. So I think I need to practice sharing my more global motivations with him and with my grown-up neighbors in a way that's meaningful. And you won't mind, I hope, if I try some of these ideas out on you. This business of having 3 chickens in my backyard, I realize, is part of my personal effort to start seeing food as more than servings of something on a plate, and rather as a spiritually charged network of living things, myself, other people, other animals. I want to embed myself more deeply in that network than I have been in the past, even though it's not currently the healthiest of systems. I want my cityscape to become part of that system's landscape. I figure if I learn just a little something about how that system works, or maybe about how true farmers do their work, or how real chickens live their lives, I might become part of a small shift toward a food system that feeds us all, body and soul. Because right now, we know that the system has enough resources flowing through it, food flowing through it, and yet by the time I finish this sentence, someone's child somewhere will have died of a hunger-related disease. The arable land of the world has been co-opted by my historical appetite for year-round peaches, year-round endive, apples from New Zealand. Instead of raising food for their own families, the system, as it is, demands millions of working people to raise food for export, not just out of their own village, not just out of their own country, but off their own continent entirely. The rural poor of the world are living on marginal land where chickens are about the only thing that can manage. And the urban hungry of the world, a population that is swelling each year as humanity surges back toward the city, live undernourished because food needs are subsumed by the struggle to pay for housing, to pay for health care. There are enough eggs on this planet to feed everyone. There is enough food everywhere, and there is still hunger because of the way the system works. Some of us think that maybe an answer to this hunger is to re-envision the city, to work urban agriculture back into the food equation, especially here in the United States where so much of the world's food resources are being consumed. You know, it's weird, actually, that John is growing up in a city where there are plenty of animals that are consumers, dogs and cats, about a million of them in the metro area, iguanas, parakeets, cockatiels, but where it's been made out of place to see productive animals, except during the 12 days that lead up to Labor Day, of course. Productive animals are part of most world cities, raised mostly by women for their own families. And they were, in fact, commonplace in American cities until well into this century. Each city's dairy was in town, and all the milk cows with it. Most working-class families kept poultry. Woodrow Wilson kept sheep on the front lawn of the White House. Would that we had that sort of leadership now. People knew and saw animals as part of the way they lived and ate in the city until after the Second World War, when the American city was redefined in part by two things. The first was the crest of a wave of classism. A conspicuous sign of having achieved the American dream was that you didn't really need to prepare, and you certainly didn't need to produce your own food, because someone was doing that for you. So in cities, complaints were made against people who were still keeping animals for food production, and those animals were pushed out of the cities. That separation was further defined by the advent of refrigerated transport, which made it plain unnecessary to keep animals in our cities. Or anywhere near them. So now, today, my food has to travel to get to me. Every bite of food has to travel to get to me, and it relies on petroleum. And right now, the trade-off is hovering right around 87 calories of fossil fuel for 1 calorie of food that gets in my mouth. I am part of that catastrophic arrangement unless I'm growing my own food. Now, I don't know how to grow my own rice. In fact, there are plenty of things that I can't grow here in Minnesota, but I could maybe redefine how I think of city, redefine my city for myself, and produce some of my food. I can bring chickens into my backyard in my own attempt to make urban agriculture a little part of the solution. And there's another result of animals' geographic relocation outside of our homes, outside of our city, really, when it comes down to it, outside of our line of sight. They're outside of our moral proximity. They've become someone else's responsibility. And in a familiar trend, there is a middle class of animals that has disappeared almost entirely. While it used to be that the family might have had Bessie the cow or Poppy the hen, an animal that was kept for a purpose but beloved all the same, that class of animal doesn't really exist in the United States anymore. Now there's this weird upper class of designer dogs that can have health insurance and orthodontics, and then there's the lower class of feedlot animals who are kept alive only as long as necessary in conditions of the barest of lives. Now, I'm okay with the idea that something has to stop living so that I can keep living. I'm okay with that. A decade ago, I decided to manage the weight of that reality with a primarily vegetarian diet. I am, however, not okay with the idea that something has to suffer so that I can keep living. 98% of the chickens in the country are kept in conditions such that they really don't do much in their life other than suffer. You know this, and I know this. What happens to chicks isn't even conversation material for a Sunday morning. And the practice of keeping 1,000 beakless chickens laying eggs 365 days a year in a constantly fluorescent lit space the size of my bathroom is not endorsed by any religious description of stewardship anywhere. Several years back, my initial response to this was to spend my dollars on organic free-range eggs. And this kind of worked until the USDA got involved in labeling, and now free-range is kind of a meaningless marketing term because it can mean that the 10,000 birds kept all in that one barn have access to one small concrete porch that's smaller than my bathroom. Uninterested in spending my moral energy navigating corporate trickery, I figured the only way to assure myself of a laying hen's quality of life was to be the steward of that hen myself. I don't purport to read my chickens' minds. It probably wouldn't be good reading anyways, but my backyard flock seems mighty happy and healthy, and they're living their species life. So it's been all these motivations that led to a commitment inside me, and the commitment has led to something new and good that I do every single day. And for me, that equals spiritual practice. Because every day, the chickens prompt me to practice mindfulness. I can get away with weeding my garden once every 2 weeks, and if there's rain, I can go a couple of days without watering. But the chickens demand that I start my day and end my day outdoors. And it's become a moment for me to pause and notice what goes on in my yard, to enjoy the still novel tableau of 3 farm animals scratching around my lawn chairs, pecking out in my backyard, to decide not to mind the drizzle because the chickens don't seem to mind it. And every day at this point, the chickens are asking me to practice patience. I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to the first eggs. They're too young to lay them right now, so I'm waiting. And the wait itself is a kind of practice, and one that I know will be so very worth it. Barbara Kingsolver and Frances Moore LePay accuse our culture of having forgotten altogether how to wait for the quality experience. We're totally okay with eating really stringy asparagus in November, and we're okay with those alien pink tomatoes that show up in March, and we're okay with watery eggs from the supermarket in December, because having it all now has become more important than having the real rich thing. But a fresh egg, a really fresh egg, as local as it gets, makes the supermarket variety pale in comparison. And you have to wait for it. You have to wait because it won't show up when you want it. It won't show up because it's the quality experience. And as with so many examples of life's abundance with eggs, you have to show up too. You have to get out there each day with your open hands, ready to accept the small, neatly packaged gifts, because if you don't, they'll come to nothing. Come October, I hope I'll be practicing showing up. And then come December, when I let the chickens rest naturally for the winter, it'll be the season of egg advent again, and I'll be waiting for the quality experience until next March. And if you all show up at church at the right time, I hope you might share in the abundance, because urban chicken keepers are categorically, absolutely delighted at their ability to share their supply and their surplus of eggs. I can hardly wait to show up at other folks' doors with my little egg basket. I look forward to, we're all out, go see if Carrie has an egg, becoming a new neighborly link. Okay, so I probably shouldn't try that all on a 9-year-old. I should maybe stick with, yeah, it is a thing. Or at most just say that what I really mean is that this little flock of 3 chickens will let me be part of some small, whole, and healthy circle. I hope that they will help me to practice compassion and gratitude. I hope that they'll be a first step toward a different way of eating. I hope, in the end, that I will let keeping these chickens and eating their brown and blue eggs be an act of worship. You might not head right home and start your own backyard flock. That's okay. You might stick with maybe the farmer's market, which is equally an act of worship. Maybe you'll try worms under your kitchen sink. Or maybe you'll try honeybees in your attic as a spiritual practice. I don't know. But I think that you might find some delicious new path for us toward a more spiritual, more sustainable food production. All that matters is that we keep looking and that we keep paying attention. And Barbara Kingsolver has some encouragement for us. She says, food is the rare moral arena in which the ethical choice is the one more likely to make us groan with pleasure. Why resist that? Why indeed? I couldn't resist it, so I hope that you'll come see me for fresh eggs. Why resist? May it be so, and soon. May you live a little bit of what we can learn from hens. May you rise early and keep busy. May you scratch out a living just enough to keep yourself plump and then spend the rest of the time chasing butterflies in the sun. May you test your wings once in a while. May you protect your chicks fiercely. May you be proud of your day's accomplishments even when they number only one. And at the end of the day, may you come in with all of us to roost. May it be so. Amen.